Thank you very much, Paul. Believe me, I'm at least as happy as you are that we're talking about early results from the LHC. That we actually have something to talk about other than Monte Carlo studies is a great moment. And it's actually a great moment for the European high energy physics community, and we have them to thank for pulling this off, because it was an enormous struggle. I'll say a little bit about that later. So I'm from the building down the road over there, and although sometimes I don't feel like I spend a lot of time here, I take about 10 trips to CERN per year, and my next trip is next week, and I'll be gone for 2.5 months. So anyway, everybody here probably knows this is the Pays de Gex. It's the region around Geneva, which is over here. Here's Lac Léman. There's the Geneva airport. This is the main CERN site right here. This is the SPS, which serves as an injector to the LHC. These are the Jura Mountains over here. The various wonderful French towns, Ferney-Voltaire is over here. This is where Voltaire wrote part of Candide. So it's a very nice area. I have gone so many times that I started taking pictures from the airplane. This is a picture over the lake as we're about to land. This is looking over at the Swiss Alps to the east. And if you look, plane turns around to the west, you look at the Rhone River going into France. So it's not a bad place to spend the next 20 years doing physics. So here's an outline. I will begin with a little bit of history, a little bit about the status of the LHC. Then I'll start with an overview of physics, cross sections, and signatures. I'll spend a fair amount of time describing the CMS detector performance and some early results. Results should really be put in quotation marks for the most part. I mean, there are detector performance results, not necessarily particularly publishable things, but there have been some papers submitted to journals on minimum bias type of phenomenology. I won't spend time on that. I will discuss the prospects for standard model measurements and new physics searches in the current run, which will extend through 2011. I think it's sort of the fall-ish 2011. And I'll cover mostly things to do with SUSY. I'm the co-convener of the SUSY group. That's what actually I know a little bit about, but I'll also say a little bit about some other topics like top quark production and Higgs. And of course, this talk is very, very far from being comprehensive. There is a Twiki page where you can get all the CMS results, and all the documentation and plots. It's not 100% up to date, but it is pretty good.
What's a Twiki?
It's one of these wiki pages. I don't know what really the whole thing about this. I write them so they can't be too hard. It's like a web page, but you can, anybody can go edit this page themselves. That's the principal characteristic. It's much easier than HTML. Okay.
Twitter did this also or something?
He's wondering where the T comes in.
The T.
Because Wiki, you described a Wiki.
Sorry. I don't know.
And doesn't the whole collaboration have to approve every day?
Okay. So.
Theorist, right?
Will you say something about Atlas?
No, I will not say about Atlas. Pretty much everything that I say about CMS is true for Atlas. So when I say the CMS performance is really, really good, that's true for Atlas. When I say that we've seen some W events, they saw some W events. I can make some comments about specific things along the way. It's just I couldn't figure out how to make a talk smooshing it all together. It has been a huge struggle to establish a TeV scale facility for our community. I was looking at some of the historical information. Chris Llewellyn Smith wrote a nice article in Nature, and you can look up that reference. There's also a rather nice book, The Large Hadron Collider, A Marvel of Technology by Lynn Evans, that contains a lot of interesting stuff about how hard this was to do. And this slide I actually took from Sarah Eno, who made a chronology. And if you go back, you can see the approval was in 1994. And you know, interleaved in here is the saga of the SSC being approved, but then being canceled. And all of this was intertwined in an extremely complex story. One thing to set the time scale of this sort of 80s, you know, when this all started, is to go back to an early proposal called Information Management by Tim Berners-Lee. This proposal concerns the management of general information about accelerators and experiments at CERN. It discusses the problems of loss of information about complex evolving system and derives a solution based on distributed hypertext system. Many of the discussions of the future at CERN and the LHC era end with the question, yes, but how will we ever keep track of such a large project? This proposal provides an answer to such questions. Firstly, it discusses the problems of information access at CERN. Then it introduces the idea of linked information system and compares them with less flexible ways of finding information. So we all know what this led to. And I remember when I first heard about, okay, we're going to use this. Yeah, fine, that's good. We can exchange our engineering documents. You know, you put your engineering documents here. We click, we get to see them. And then somebody said, you know, people are going to make money with this. And we said, no, there's no way anybody is going to make money with this. This clearly demonstrated beyond any shadow of doubt that we should be physicists and that we shouldn't do anything else. So it's a lot of water under this bridge since this era. Okay, so what do we have after this time? Well, we have this superb instrument that will support a 20-year physics program. It has about 9,000 total magnets, including the dipoles, the quadrupoles, all the correctors. Here are all the numbers. It will get to 2,800 bunches per proton beam. There will be of order many hundreds of millions collisions per second in this that the detectors have to keep up with or deal with somehow, both in the radiation damage sense and in the data acquisition sense. So of order a billion collisions a second is a rather daunting thing, and people used to think, in the early discussions, this was considered utterly insane. The spacing between the bunches is 25 nanoseconds, 7 meters. This was also considered insane to build magnets, maybe it is, 8.33 Tesla. Current of 11,000 amps. And just in case no one, maybe you haven't seen what's really inside one of those big blue things, there's a common volume for both beams. And here you can see the two apertures for the two proton beams that are rotating in opposite directions. The overall length of this thing is about 16, 17 meters. The magnetic length is slightly less than that. The magnets actually curve a teeny weeny bit because the beams curve inside of these apertures, and you would lose some of the aperture if you didn't curve the magnets a little bit. So here's a picture of the CMS detector, which is not very helpful. So I'll show you another one. But here's a person right here. And it's got a diameter of around 15 meters. The thing that you mostly notice is the muon system. This red stuff, it actually is painted red. So when you see the real thing, you see the red of the iron in here. And then there are muon chambers interleaved in that. The iron serves as the flux return. So there's a magnetic field that's axial in this region. It comes out and it returns back, a solenoidal field back through the iron. This inside of there's a superconducting coil of 4 Tesla. It's actually run at 3.8 Tesla. And then there's two calorimetry systems, a hadronic calorimeter, which is scintillator and brass interleaved. And then inside of that, a lead tungstate electromagnetic calorimeter made of these beautiful lead tungstate crystals. And I'll show you some results from them. The tracking system inside is the largest silicon tracker ever built, and it has about 200 square meters, almost 10 million silicon strip channels. Our group here built a significant chunk of this, and we are heavily invested in the tracking system. Inside of that, there is a pixel system which has three barrel layers and is really a beautiful piece of the system that is very powerful for vertexing, 66 million channels and about a meter squared of the pixels. So that's kind of the overview, and this is another view, which, just to repeat, the tracking system, the calorimeters, the coil, and the muon system. There's a forward hadronic calorimeter right here, and all of these systems in here have forward components that I'll show you in more detail as we go through. So there's this beautiful arcy line here which shows you the trajectory of a muon that originated from the interaction point. This is just a little wedge of the detector, and you can see how it curves one way and then it starts curving the other way, and that's because the magnetic field has returned, came out of the main barrel region, comes back and is pointing the other way, and so you get this characteristic S-shaped thing. These are the patterns made by various particles. A photon doesn't leave any hits in the tracking system. Well, unless it converts, which they do a lot of the time, because there's so much material in the tracker that we have photons converting into E plus E minus pairs some of the time. And then, but you get a photon shower in the cesium, not the cesium, that was my last experiment, the lead tungstate state calorimeter. You have a neutral hadron that makes a shower in the hadronic calorimeter. A charged hadron right here leaves hits in the tracking system and then produces a shower in the hadronic calorimeter. And then the muon leaves charged, leaves hits in the tracker, makes it all the way through to the muon system. So that's the kind of the zeroth order description. This is the tracker installation. These guys here, these are people with their little white helmets down here, and this is the tracker being inserted into the central bore of the detector. It's the site for CMS is in a little town called Cessy in France, and it's on the opposite side of the ring from where the CERN campus is. We had a long time due to the accident to look at cosmic rays. We collected many millions of cosmic rays, and it turns out that one of the reasons that both ATLAS and CMS are working so well is that we had a lot of time to look at cosmic rays and align the detector with them. And so here you see, this is the pixel right here. This is the inner part of the silicon tracker, the outer part of the silicon tracker, and we have huge numbers of these tracks. Here's now zooming out, and you see the muon system here. So a lot of alignment and calibration was performed on most parts of the detector with cosmics. So then in November and December in 2009, we had a run first at 0.9 TeV and then at 2.36 TeV. This is an event. Basically, it was a small number of min bias events, about 350,000 events at 0.9 TeV, 20,000 events at 2.36 TeV. This run was notable for the fact that I won a bottle of very expensive wine with a person at Fermilab, and the bet was whether we, by the end of 2009, would exceed the injection energy of the machine. So the beams arrive into the LHC at 450 GeV, so that's where this number comes from. This is no acceleration. And then at the very end of the run in December, they ramped up to 2.36 TeV. And so that was the first time that the LHC was actually accelerating.
What are you turning on and off to do to accomplish that?
The RF system. The magnets are just guiding things around.
I guess you didn't plan to say much about ATLAS 5, but are there some parallels you can draw with what you described?
It's completely parallel. It's utterly parallel. So, yeah, they have events that look like this, and there really isn't particularly a difference. So this was a great moment. Collisions at 7 TeV. Nous avons réussi. We've succeeded, lots of happy people in all the control rooms, and believe me, you know, proton physics, stable beams, that's what it's about. So when we saw, you know, stable beams, we are really, was a milestone, and the beams are very stable, you know, operating for 30 hours in the machine. The current luminosity record is 10 to the 28th per centimeter squared per second. This is small, but it's definitely, but there's been an order of magnitude increase recently. There's only a few more orders of magnitude to go. Things are on track in the sense that a lot of the work going on is understanding the magnetic properties, the beam orbits, the tunes, emittance behavior, and things like this that is being done very systematically. And the models that are used to describe the machine are working very well. So I think that there is a sense of optimism, but it is a very complicated machine, so it'll take a little while. This is a picture showing something about CMS operations at 7 TeV, various components of the detector, what fraction of these systems are operating. The scale starts at 90%, goes up to 100. So, you know, when you want to do physics, you want to have a very high operational fraction for all the subsystems. Going to your question about Atlas, they have a chart that looks just like this, where everything is, you know, up at 98%, 99%. So things are working very well from the detector point of view. And I'll come back and show you some detector performance plots. So now turning a little bit to an overview about the physics. This is a plot that's been shown a million times showing cross-section for various processes as a function of root S. The LHC, this is up here at 14 TeV, we're actually right now at 7 TeV. But you see the total inelastic cross-section up here. And then what's striking about this is just the enormous numbers of orders of magnitude that one has in going between, let's say, a QCD process of producing BB bar down to the processes that we're interested in. You have W production right here, which is one of the largest electroweak processes. Then we have gluino production down here. Okay, and you're starting to get down to the picobarn range. So a picobarn is a good kind of cross-section to think about in terms of what do we need for to access to get to a lot of the new physics. Now, people looked at, first we thought we were going to run at 10 TeV, and then it was, for reasons to do with the accelerator, it was decided it would be more prudent to run at 7. So this is a plot that shows the quark and QQ bar and gluon luminosities as a function of the S hat, or the center of mass energy of the system you would produce. And this is the ratio between 10 and 7, so we could sort of get a sense of what we were losing going from 10 to 7. And it's roughly a factor of 3 to 4. It depends on what kind of process that you're looking at. This is a comparison right here of the sort of effective luminosities between 7 TeV at the LHC versus the Tevatron. And you can see that depends highly on whether you have a QQ bar process or a gluon process. But the LHC still has a large advantage. I mean, 7 TeV is worth a lot compared to 2 TeV. And I'll say a lot more about these. There were some presentations on Wednesday of this week. Here's the link. And there were presentations that covered somewhat more comprehensively some of the physics reach issues and including both Atlas and CMS. I'll come back to this later. I'll give you specific predictions about SUSY searches. But basically, we're pretty optimistic that this run does have physics potential. So this is for orientation. So here's the cross-section in picobarns for W plus jets, where W decays into any of the lepton neutrino modes. 28,000 picobarn cross-section. Then that's this bar. Then you go down, the next biggest thing is Z plus jets. And then TT bar looks like a little pancake, so then we expand the pancake up here. This is 165 picobarns. And this is where things start to really get interesting. You have single top production, various possibilities for how that happens. And then diboson production, W plus W minus is 43, WZ 18, ZZ is 5.9. So all of these...
Jets here are defined as what?
I'm sorry, are included.
Jets here are defined as what? What is the definition of
a jet? Well, what is the definition of a jet?
20G.
Yeah, something like that. Below 2030, we don't have really a meaningful jet concept. So these are just a little orientation about some of the SUSY production mechanisms we hope that we are going to someday see. You have gluon-gluon interactions, quark, anti-quark, quark, gluon. This is only a few of the diagrams. There are many, many more. It's a very complicated set of processes that all could lead into SUSY production. This is a plot right here that just for some, you don't know what these mean, but these are benchmark models that we use in CMS, and I'll say more about them later. But different ones of these different benchmark models give you different, the production is often squark-gluino, but you have gluino-gluino and squark-anti-squark, and depends somewhat on the model, and some of the models are kind of crazy, and the masses are such that you could get neutralino-chargino a lot, you know, but this doesn't mean that the cross-section is large, it just means for that particular model, a lot of the production is through that mechanism. So it has very light charginos and neutralinos. Here, this is a scan that we did of M. Sugra, and I should preface it by saying every time we talk to theorists, they say, oh, we hate M. Sugra, don't talk about M. Sugra, don't use M. Sugra, don't show anything about it. So that's a long discussion. I'd be actually happy to have it. For historical reasons, it's very hard to not talk about it, because if you want to compare it with the what we have learned from CDF and LEP, and you need to orient yourself, you kind of have to put that down there and know where can you go beyond that. So I agree with all the limitations of M. Sugra, and I understand that. We do have other approaches that we're looking at where we look at much more generic signatures that undo some of the M. Sugra constraints, like the ratios of the masses of the gluino to the LSP and so forth. So we know about that, but okay, so here's the M. Sugra plane, M a half versus M naught. This is happens to be for tan beta of 3. And what I just want to show you here is get a sense of how the cross-section behaves. And you can see sort of in here, this is one pico barn, okay? So here's a really simple calculation. We're going to get about an inverse femto barn. That means that for this region, we're going to have about 1,000 events, because it's a one pico barn cross-section. So by the end of this year, we'll have 100 inverse pico barns, so we'll have 100 events for processes like this. And that gives you some sense. I mean, as an experimental, you got to have some events to analyze. If there are no events, you might as well not even talk about it. Here is a line that I just drew by hand, which is the rough limit from the Tevatron. Okay, that's where they're sitting. We have defined a benchmark called LM0, which Atlas also, I think they call it SP4. No, wait. I don't know. It doesn't matter.
SU4.
SU4, thank you. I think SU is for supersymmetry. I don't know why they called it SU. Okay.
It's not for special unitary.
It's not for special unitary. Anyway, this model that we talk about sometimes sits right on this line, so that we have some way of saying, this is a benchmark. It sits at the current edge of their sensitivity, and here's another model. Okay, so adding these models, some of these benchmarks on, just to compare, you can see now TT bar looks kind of big and scary, 165 pico barn. So all of a sudden you're thinking, okay, you know, way up above the ceiling is W plus jets, and it's gone by now. So when you think about what sort of backgrounds you have to contend with to be able to have sensitivity to these models. You have to be able to suppress the W plus jets. When the W decays into a lepton or neutrino, it will give you missing energy. And you're going to have to suppress all these other guys. So that's some sort of perspective on most of what we do as experimentalists. We never really think much about SUSY and all these models you guys come up with. What we do, you're like, what do? Well, we eat in a certain cafeteria, drink, and then we try to figure out how to get rid of these backgrounds. But more importantly, how are we going to know how much background is left without relying on your predictions, because we don't believe you. No insult or anything, we just don't. And so we have to figure out how to use the data to measure the backgrounds. Okay, so a basic SUSY program in the initial phase has to be very inclusive. We don't do really elaborate measurements where, I've seen these things that people cook up with 300 inverse femtobarns of data, really complicated. These are simple, let's say, dumb analyses. They're inclusive. And you have, SUSY decay chains are very complicated. So you're trying to inclusively sum up over as many of these signatures as you can in some rational way. So the plan that both ATLAS and CMS have are very similar. It's a coherent survey of simple inclusive signatures, many of which, but not all, involve missing transverse momentum, sometimes called net missing transverse energy. The reason that it's called that is that the quantity is measured in the calorimeter, which we think of as an energy measuring device, but it's kind of a silly term. But we don't just want to look for the standard SUSY things. We want to look for weird things, exotic signatures, like the things you get from split SUSY, where you have particles that go out in the calorimeter and then they sit there for a week and then they decay. So I show you an example of that. We have a jillion searches where every little university group gets to look for some bizarre thing. So that when you come up with these weird models that you do, it's very helpful because then all these groups get to look for something. So there are, roughly speaking, when you diagonalize this search space, we look at 0 leptons, 1 lepton, 2 leptons, at least 3 leptons, roughly speaking. As we commission our experiment, we will be adding fancy things like B-tagging, taus, and top. And this is going very fast. I mean, I think that it will not be long at all before we have B-tagging operational at a pretty good quality. So we have we have different ways of approaching the jets. We look at photons. For dileptons, we look at like sign and opposite sign. And our approach is that the standard for discovery is enormously high. We've all seen historically how there have been false alarms. So our approach is data-driven background methods, pursue multiple approaches, and use as many cross-checks as possible. So in a given search, like the single lepton search, we might have 7 different methods running in parallel, all of which are using different approaches to trying to get the backgrounds, and we'll cross-check them and see if they agree.
Well, some people say that it's very difficult to use missing ET in early stages analysis because it is difficult to understand the data perfectly. What is going to be the situation?
I will discuss that. That's an excellent question. We're reasonably optimistic. We think the conventional wisdom is that we wouldn't be able to use missing transverse energy for a long time until many, many, many things were understood. And the indications so far are that that's not the case. I'll show you some plots. So here's experimentalists versus theorists. Theorists ask, how will we know if the new physics is SUSY? Okay, this is the question we would love to have to try to answer. How will we determine the mass scale and the full spectrum? How will we determine the underlying Lagrangian? Okay, what do we think about? Is there a leak? Will the trigger work? How much calorimeter noise is there? How big is the QCD background? How can we be confident it's not just the standard model plus the tails of experimental distributions? So these are all good questions. I have no objection to these questions. That's just not where we are, and we won't be there for quite a while. So when we at this point, what we do with the data is we are commissioning, okay? We have to go through all the subsystems, all the ingredients of the experiment, and understand them in a lot of detail, and I won't drag you through all these, but I am going to show you some examples of the things we're doing with the data so far. So, reminding you about the inner region of the tracker, we have a pixel system. It's really cute, it looks like that. It has these three barrel layers right here, and the pixel size is 100 microns by 150 microns, has very good tracking resolutions, huge number of pixels, 66 million. This is operational about 98% level, and it's 97% efficiency. So these are very good signs. The strip system, this photo shows you what it looks like in the inner barrel region, which is right here. There's an outer barrel here. There are end regions. This is split, only showing half the detector in Z, the plus Z region. There's the minus Z region, which is symmetrical. So these are silicon wafers about a third or a half a millimeter thick. They're basically like diodes that are subdivided into little strips with pitches that are like this. 97% of these little guys are working.
What's the difference between the pixel tracker and silicon strips, and what are they?
So a strip is a thing that's like this long. It's an implanted region into silicon. And what you do is if this is a wafer, let's pretend that this is a wafer. It's divided into strips like this. There may be 1,000 of them this way. And when a particle goes through the silicon thickness of about 300 microns, that's depleted, and the ionization that is produced as the particle traverses is collected on the strip. Now it. Because it's a strip, it's only giving you the coordinate this way. It's just which strip is hit gives you a coordinate this way. Now you say, well, let's have some strips going the other way, on the other side, okay? And so they measure the other coordinate. That does lead to a pattern recognition issue where you could have ambiguities, because if you have multiple hits, you might not know which strip on one side goes with the strip on the other side. So the pixel system, there really is a little square. It's an individual detector, okay, with these very small dimensions. So now the reason that there are fewer of them is that you get an enormous number of these channels, and they're very expensive, so you currently don't have the resources to instrument the entire experiment with pixels.
How close are the first layers to the beam?
They're close. So here are the numbers. 4.3 centimeters is the closest right there. Okay, so here's some plots now showing the performance of the system. There's Mike. He'll appreciate the signal to noise plot of the this MPV is most probable value of the signal to noise is 26:1. And the red is the expectation from Monte Carlo. And this is for the tracker inner barrel and the tracker outer barrel. So we have very good signal to noise. And there's a document about this, which I gave the reference earlier to the Twiki page, and you can get all of these documents. This is the K short decaying into pi plus pi minus mass peak. This is the data, this is Monte Carlo. The resolutions of these are very similar to what we expected. We've observed K-shorts, phis, D-stars, lambdas, weird baryons that you probably don't even remember exist. I'll show you a couple of them, but they're looking very nice. Here's a rather complicated thing. Here you see lambdas decaying into p pi minus right here. Cascade baryons, I don't know if anybody's even heard of that in this room. This is where string theory came from, right? Was trying to describe baryons. So you should, this is where it all came from. There's the omega minus. So all of these things are making appearances, and it's great for the graduate students. Graduate students get to see all these particles from the particle data group. Now they believe us that they exist.
Can I ask a
here's some...
No, energy physics, that's nuclear physics.
Just nature.
Calibrated.
So here are some D signals, the D0 decaying into K minus pi plus, K pi pi. There's a D star signal, even it's amazing to me that we get can do the D star trick. J psi's are starting to appear, decaying into
U
plus.
You don't need the bar anymore.
What?
You don't need the bar anymore.
Okay, we have seen a few events where there are two primary vertices in the event, so you can see right here that there were a couple of collisions in the same event. And this is something that we're going to have to worry about in the future.
So how hard are those? There's multiple interactions.
They're rare.
They're rare,
but as the intensity goes up...
They won't be in the future.
They won't be rare, and it will certainly complicate our physics analysis.
But, how hard are those?
These are just minimum bias. They're very soft. Yeah. We're relying on the fact that when we get a lot of these, they're likely to be, one hard scatter with a bunch of min bias that we don't have to worry too much about. So I mentioned earlier this electromagnetic calorimeter with all of these fancy crystals. They're very radiation hard, and they're very fast. They give you most of their light output in 25 nanoseconds, which is the time interval between successive crossings when all the RF buckets are filled with beams. I don't want to go through the details here. This is a little bit technical, but I will show you the result is that these are the pi zero mass peaks. So when the pi zero decays into two photons, you reconstruct a pi zero mass peak. Here's the data. Here's the Monte Carlo. And, of course, one of these days we're going to try to do this outrageous measurement where Higgs goes to gamma-gamma, and maybe someday a little way up at some, 120 GeV, we'll see Higgs to gamma-gamma. But that will be quite a while. But this instrument was built so that we would have the capability to do Higgs to gamma-gamma with a high-resolution device. Here's some other plots showing the pseudorapidity of the pi zero to gamma-gamma candidates, the PT distributions. And everybody was really surprised that the Monte Carlo worked so well on many, many distributions. There are some where it did not, but by and large, it held up quite well. And here are some jets in the 2009 data, which are a little bit wimpy. It was a low energy run, and you can see the usual plot of pseudorapidity versus phi and some jets here that had energies of about 40 GeV. And then more recent running, this is a dijet at 7 TeV, and this is, now these jets are serious. The dijet mass is 760 GeV, and the individual jet energies are around 250. So this is starting to look like real high PT physics now. Just to give you an indication, there are thousands of distributions that people are looking at to compare the data in the Monte Carlo and see how well things are agreeing, seeing if something looks fishy. These are distributions of the jets, and you can see the PT, the eta, the phi. These are tiny, this is this tiny sample at 0.9 GeV, so this is really not a lot of data, but you can see that the things are pretty encouraging.
The missing ET is important.
You haven't seen the missing ET yet. Well, this one is missing ET over the sum of the ETs of the jets. Okay, but so the missing ET, is the next couple of slides. We identified some noise in the calorimeter in the HF, which is the forward calorimeter, and I think I pointed that out earlier. And the electromagnetic calorimeter had another kind of noise. People jumped all over this, and there was a lot of progress. So this shows you the data at 0.9 TeV. The points with the little dots are with no cleanup. It's just, and you see there's this big tail out here, which was worrisome. And then people started to understand what this was due to and were able to identify some criteria to clean this up. And you can see after the successive hadronic forward calorimeter cleanup, and then there had to be also cleanup on the eCal. It pulled this tail down to here. So there's still maybe a little bit going on here. But if I show you now, this is the data versus Monte Carlo compare, Monte Carlo's in pink, and then the data are the points. So this is one particular way we calculate net, and I won't go into the technicalities, but it uses tracking information in addition to the calorimeter. This is the met, and then this is looking at the X and Y components. So instead of starting at zero, you can actually have negative values. Remember that we don't measure the missing energy in the Z direction, because we don't know the center of mass in the Z direction. We can only do this in the XY direction transverse to the beam. So you can see over many orders of magnitude, there's a pretty good agreement between the simulation and the data. This is a plot showing the resolution of the individual X and Y components as a function of the total energy in the jets, and there's a comparison of data and simulation. So that's pretty amazing. Nobody thought that this would be so good at this stage.
So the simulation is based on the existing tunes of the generator?
Yes, it is. And the tunes of Pythia, this is something I'm not an expert on. Okay, but I do know that it's not giving enough soft tracks. So when you look at the distribution of the sum of ET by itself, you don't get enough at the low end at all. Okay, it's really missing that. These plots are not sensitive to that limitation of the Monte Carlo. This is really a detector thing. So there's some W's and Z's, and we don't expect many at this stage because we only have an inverse nanobarn. But here, let's see, so we've found three W to E nu candidates and three W to mu nu candidates. We should have eight or six. There should be 0.8 Z and there's one Z. So here is an event where this thing represents the energy deposited in the electromagnetic calorimeter. This has 37 GeV of met. The transverse mass that you can construct a mass by putting these two things together, which is kind of like the W mass, but it's missing the longitudinal piece because we don't know that. So that transverse mass is 71 GeV. It's reasonable. And then here's an event where now we're zooming out and looking at the muon system, and there are this is a nice muon. This green arrow is the missing transverse momentum vector, also over here. So they're nice looking events.
So that makes you feel good about missing energy in the 35 or 40 GeV region, because the numbers are reasonable.
Yeah, at some level. This is a Z event. This is the energy in the electromagnetic calorimeter. So looks like what Z's ought to look like. So now I'm going to turn to a different part of this talk where I want to talk about the progression in luminosity in the 7 TeV run. So the plan is that by ICHEP in Paris, we're going to have of order an inverse picobarn. And then by the end of this calendar year, we'll have roughly 100 inverse picobarns. That will be accumulated before December, because in December there's supposed to be a heavy ion run. I forget exactly the date. But we're not going to be operating in the very end of the year for the normal proton-proton physics. And then in the next year, through fall of 2011, we're supposed to get an inverse femtobarn. So if you remember my plot about the SUSY cross-sections, I said a lot of them are sort of at the 1 picobarn range. Then for those kinds of models, this would produce 1,000 events. Okay, so that leads to various phases of the physics program. And so at the beginning, we're looking at the biggest cross-sections at the beginning, the QCD and Bs. Then we move on. We have a very strong program right now to look at the W and Z cross-sections, which will lead to a broader electroweak program. TT bar observation may occur the summer, should be the summer, and should be with this amount of data at ICHEP. There'll be some early searches. There are some weird things that can turn up with small amounts of integrated luminosity. Then here, you start to really develop a top physics program. You do broad searches, mainly exotic and SUSY. And then when you're up here, you can really start the Higgs program. So now you may say, well, do you guys who do SUSY and Higgs, do you just wait around until all this is done? So actually, that's not what we do. We try to figure out how to control all these backgrounds that are starting to come in one at a time and make sure that we understand them in detail. Because that's really the critical part of the measurement. So Paul, you told me that I had an hour and a half?
Yeah, we feel free to use an hour and a half. All right.
So that's going to be fine. So I want to say a little bit about some of the searches in SUSY and Higgs and what they're like and what they might lead to. This is the spectrum of one of the benchmarks that I mentioned was right on the edge of the CDF sensitivity. It has a very light LSP, a neutralino chi-1 down here. The gluino is also light, around 400 GeV. And because it's so light, you get a large cross-section, so 40 picobarns. So that would, even with one inverse picobarn, we would have 40 events, which would not be enough to really establish a signal, but is already starting to, would be produced at a reasonable rate. So that gives you some sense that even with one inverse picobarn of integrated luminosity, we're starting to talk to the kind of the near the edge of where the tevatron is. Now, in a model like this, you can produce gluinos, and then they could decay into squarks, or like the B1 squark. And here's just to put some concreteness to it, various decay modes of the B1. It could decay into a T1 and a W. Or it could decay into a neutralino and a B, or a chargino and a top, just as examples. And then you cascade down until you get all the way down to the LSP. You can have leptons accompanying these things for when the chi-2 decays into a chi-1. So it leads to all these signatures. And I said earlier that we try to take this inclusive approach, where we look at very simple signatures inclusively. Oh, this is another slide that shows the gluino in this model decays into B1, B bar 54% of the time, and decays down here into a T1 and a W 43% of the time. Not that this is a particularly compelling model, it just happens to be a benchmark. This is some information about these, but I don't want to talk about it. Okay, so I've already said that we don't want to rely on predicted cross-sections, particularly QCD, in order to establish the amount of background that we have. And we also don't really want to rely on the predicted kinematic distributions very much, although in some cases those can be very useful, if in some cases they're robust. So if you go to the conferences and listen to people, you hear an awful lot about data-driven background determinations, which is a very challenging thing to do in this Hadron Collider environment, because you basically have to establish control samples. And from these control samples, you have to know how they would, they need to be dominated by some simple set of backgrounds, and you need to be able to identify them in some way with the amount of background that you have in your signal region. So I will not be explaining how we do this in this talk. It's just a whole struggle and a big subject, but I'm happy to take questions about that. One aspect of this is that these methods often do suffer some limitations, either systematical or systematic, statistical or systematic, excuse me, that reduce the precision of the measurement. So if you had a 100% reliable Monte Carlo, that would be great, but we just don't feel that that's appropriate at this stage. So here's an example of just a little bit about a hadronic search for SUSY, where all you do is you look for some jets and missing transverse energy. And I don't go into the details at all, but just to let you know that we have a dijet analysis. We have two jets, typically greater than 50 GeV in transverse momentum. And then we also look for up to 3 to 6 jets. And this variable called alpha t was actually suggested by Lisa Randall and in this paper here, and it was really intended to make sure that experimentalists were looking at the diget plus net, which I don't think there was so much effort on. This method has the great virtue that if you look at this variable alpha t, the QCD background has the shape here. Now, you pay attention to these numbers of order of magnitude, 10 to the 6 down to 1. So this background in this variable is falling by 6 orders of magnitude along this edge. And right now what we're doing is we're trying to see if we believe that that edge is really going to do that, or if it's going to leak out over here.
This is QCD diget exclusive, right?
This is Monte Carlo.
Yeah, I'm just saying by what you mean by QCD is...
It's diget.
Diget, yeah, but...
Well, it's multi-jet. It has some multi-jet.
But multi-jet has to leak out.
Yes, it has...
If you really include multi-jet...
Yeah, well, but there are cuts in this sample that try to suppress the multi-jets, and then this sample has...
But you're starting with the full Monte Carlo, not a diget.
You're starting with the full Monte Carlo, and then... But this has all the back... This has... all of that full Monte Carlo, which has the multi-jets in it, but then you're applying cuts to try to isolate a diget sample here and then analyze a multi-jet sample over here.
Because if this really sharp edge is really full.
Yeah, but you veto when you observe and when you observe.
Back to back, that's the feature of it.
Right. So this variable is, well, if you look at this variable, you can see that it knows about the angle in here.
Yeah, yeah.
And if the jets are not back to back,
then
it will go over here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what this does, because the cosine will be a negative number and then a negative.
That's what I'm saying. This edge is really the feature.
Right. So this is an example of something that we consider part of our commissioning program. We're taking QCD events now, and we're looking at this, and we're looking, it's more of a complicated story because this is a function of other things going on, such as the total transverse momentum in the event summed over all the jets. But these lines over here are the Suzy piece, okay, and this is 100 inverse picobarn at 10. One thing I should say is that when the decision was taken to go from 10 to 7, we haven't had time to update a lot of these analyses, so you have to sort of say, okay, the scaling means that in order to do the same thing as this, I'd have to get 3 times as much data. Okay, but it gives you a sense that in this analysis you would have real sensitivity in these two channels. So we have...
Is the QCD Pissian?
Or is it MagGraph? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, it's option MagGraph.
I think it's MagGraph, actually. MagGraph. I can check.
Oh.
I'll check for you.
Well, you have to go through Pissian.
Yeah, no, of course. You always have the Pissian. So this is a sensitivity plot, and it was designed to answer a question of whether the run at 7 TeV would have sensitivity beyond the Tevatron. And the Tevatron... So here's LEP, LEP 2, and also this region. They had Slepton searches and Chargino searches. This is the CDF all-hadronic search at 2 inverse femtobarns. And then this is the D0 all-hadronic search. By holotronic, I mean jets plus MET. This is a 95% confidence level exclusion limit where we might be at 100 inverse picobarns, say, and then this is where we'll be after an inverse femtobarn. So we think we are going to be able to have sensitivity to quite a bit of additional territory. Now this is a complicated plot, and I can answer questions about it, but one important thing is to understand that gluino mass is approximately a horizontal line. So you go up in gluino mass this way. Squark mass are these sort of elliptical things, and you can see a squark mass of 1 TeV, and down here a gluino mass of 500 GeV. So one caveat about M. Sugra is that people like to say, ah, so your line is here. That means you're going to exclude a gluino up to such and such a mass. Now that statement is model dependent in the sense that if you depart from M. Sugra, the spectra can change in such a way that you could have a gluino of that mass that we wouldn't exclude in this non-M. Sugra scenario. So one always has to understand that. the value of tan beta in a hadronic search is not very important. You can make this at some other tan betas, whatever you like, 50, 3, and it's not going to change where these are. We've done that. So hadronic searches doesn't care about that. Okay, another example, which is extremely different, you may have heard, about these people, and they have predicted there's a scenario, split Suzy, which is, okay, it's over here. So you have a very, very heavy squirk, and so you get a Gluino, and its lifetime is really, really long. And it's so long, it goes out into your detector, and instead of decaying, it just stops. And it just sits there in your calorimeter or any place that it's where it's run out of energy, and it decays maybe even when the accelerator was turned off and we're not even doing anything, right? So we decided to set up a search for this and search for long-lived particles that stop in the detector. So there's this weird phenomenology about how these guys can fragment into R hadrons. And these R hadrons are these bizarre analogs of ordinary hadrons. And that had to be cooked up. This is a map of essentially the material in the experiment and where they would stop, and you can see the pieces of the familiar pieces of the apparatus. So this a map was made of where the R hadrons would stop, and then this is a picture of the stopping efficiency, which is of order 10%. Some people might trust more the electromagnetic piece only than the strong interaction, the nuclear interaction piece of this. It's a little bit squishy, but it gives you a sense. And then if you, the trigger efficiency for this is about 30%, and the efficiency after all the cuts is 20%. So it's actually not too bad. This is a simulated event of where the this gluino would decay in the calorimeter, and you get a big splash there. An odd feature of this is that when do you take data? Well, when are you supposed to take? You take data anytime the beam is off. So, or you could take data, you have a series of bunches, you could take data between when there's a whole string of bunches and then there's an empty space where the bunches are not arriving, the beam is off, you could take data there and then you would see this decay thing. So the people who did this basically tried to find every little niche where you had, no beam and try to cover that. And they have been studying the backgrounds using all this data that we had where the LHC was off. We were taking cosmic rays, and they were looking at the detector noise, and basically the rate of background is something like 4×10⁻⁴ hertz. It has an interesting property that S over the square root of B, which is the figure of merit for significance, goes like luminosity times time for the signal, and B, doesn't have anything to do with the luminosity anymore because it's not being related. And so you have this behavior that the time in order to establish some fixed significance goes as luminosity squared rather than luminosity, which is the normal thing. So if the luminosity is low, you have a very hard time. So here's some examples of sensitivity curves, and these assume 10^32, which is where we would get to by the end of this run. And these are 7 TeV. And so you can see, as a function of the number of days here, when would you get to 5 sigma? Okay, it's actually, and these are for certain gluino masses, which you may or may not believe, but okay. So it's a start of, even during this run, we will be doing this.
So have you looked at the possibility that this stable gluino can be charged tracks?
Yes, there is a whole other analysis for that, absolutely.
But it's not included in this.
That's not in this. Okay. No, there's a separate analysis. Okay, I want to say a little bit about TOP, which is one of the major standard model benchmark processes. It looks just like SUSY. In some sense, it's like SUSY. It's a model of SUSY. It has many jets. It has missing momentum. It has leptons. It's a key background in almost every single SUSY search that we perform, including like-sign dileptons. So this is a plot that shows the this analysis in the mu plus mu minus channel, just to orient you, what do you see when you look at opposite sign dileptons? Well, you get Drellian, you get this big thing, okay, so and you can suppress the Z part of that, but you still get the non-Z part of it. And then you have TT bar, okay, and you can see the typical kinds of net values that you have here. So that's at sort of a baseline selection. And then if you look in EE, mu mu, and then mu E gets rid of the Drellian because you don't have opposite flavors being produced in the Drellian. And then this is the total. The axis here is the number of jets, and you can see that that some of the backgrounds really like to have small numbers of jets, like W plus jets mostly has zero, and then it will have one or two at a smaller rate. Now, if you then make a requirement on MET, then you start to beat down these backgrounds, and you can see that as you go to higher numbers of jets, the background really isn't so big. So this is just an example of how much detailed work has to go in, because you can see there's lots of backgrounds that have to be individually understood. So here's an expectation. I'm not going to go into these details, but in the EMU mode, for example, you would have a signal to background of 9 to 1, and that would lead, already with 10 inverse picobarns, you would have around a 15% statistical error. So this plot is, this is at 10 TeV. So it's going to be 30 inverse picobarns at 7 TeV. So this is what it would look like. Your signal is this much, and then these are the various backgrounds. The total background is right here. A data-driven background estimate, which you have to do just what you would do in the data, came up with this number as compared to that. So that's a good sign. That says we know how to determine the background without cheating and asking what the Monte Carlo says.
Are the data-driven completely independent of Monte Carlo?
Almost entirely, yeah. I mean, the only ones that are really not are the Dye boson ones, where you basically say that there's just this tiny amount. So you, I think you just take a cross-section. So this search would lead very naturally into a SUSY search, and this is just one very simple example of how that works. So you could be looking for a neutralino decaying into a lepton and a slepton. The slepton decays into a lepton and the LSP. So here is a plot of the dilepton mass, and you can see that you can take these leptons to be the same flavor as each other, and that would normally be the case here. You would normally have this lepton and that lepton would be the same flavor as each other. Okay. You can then look for an opposite flavor control sample, where in SUSY you do get that too, because the leptons don't have to have been produced in this correlated manner in a SUSY event, but it includes all the background from TT bar. So if you subtracted what you observed in the opposite flavor control sample, you would be subtracting not only the standard model, where TT bar gives you opposite flavor because the two W's decay independently, you would also be just subtracting a lot of SUSY quote-unquote background. So it's not the optimal method in some sense, but it's a simple one to explain to you. And so what you could do with that, for example, is study this edge, which is this famous dilepton edge, the endpoint, and this is what this would look like at 200 inverse picobarns at 10 TeV. So this is a famous thing. I don't think I need to explain it to this audience. You can fit for this edge and extract it with a reasonably good precision, but it's very hard to tell with this amount of data whether it was really a two-body sequential two-body decay where everything was on shell here and you have the slepton mass entering this formula, or whether it was a three-body decay, because you just don't have enough data to do that. But if we saw an edge like this, believe me, we would all be celebrating. I mean, this would be a huge deal if something like this were observed. So I wanted to say a little bit about the like sign dilepton search, because this is a classic SUSY signature that has a tiny standard model background. And in order to do this, you have to have very reliable data-driven background estimates. I won't go through all the details and the cuts, but you could, just to give you a cartoon picture, how does the standard model give you like sign dileptons? So imagine you made a TT bar system, and then over here, the T decays into a W and a B, and the W gives you a real lepton, okay? On the other side, the top could decay into a, essentially the same thing, a W and a B. This W decays into a lepton, and you misidentify the charge. You just get it wrong. Now, this almost never happens with muons, but it does happen a little bit of the time with electrons. So you have to be able to go measure what fraction of the time. And these are tiny numbers, okay? But your signal is also tiny. So it's sort of a trade-off of you have this sensitivity, and in order to exploit it, you have to really measure all of these contributions. Another case is where you have a real lepton over here, but the lepton on this side doesn't come from the W boson decay, it comes from the B quark decay. And then it will be the same sign. It just always will be the same sign. But this lepton will normally be sitting near or inside the B jet. And so one measures how much energy is nearby that lepton. This is called isolation. And most leptons can be vetoed as being surrounded by lots of activity in the tracker or the calorimeter. So this is has to be done very carefully. And this is an exclusion plot. This is kind of a cute curve here that people were wondering about, like, did you do this right or not? So this is the M-Sugra plane again. This region is from the CDF and D0 tri-lepton searches, which is kind of the comparable in some sense to this search. And this dotted line is where we would be with 100 inverse picobarns, and this is where we would be with 1 inverse femtobarn. So when we made this plot, the management called this the Alpa de Huez plot, and I didn't really know what that was. It turns out that there's this mountains in France where they go on the Tour de France, and somebody thought this reminded them of that and wanted to know if the structure, all these wiggles, were really corresponded to anything physical. So this is the map of the ski slopes there. And so we looked into this, and what's really going on is that it does reflect the structure of the M-Sugra plane in terms of where the dileptons, like sign dileptons, come from. And there's this diagonal band here in when you look at the branching fractions. And then there's, in addition to that, the cross section is falling off this way as the gluino mass goes up. So that's what that big mountain range corresponds to. And the little wiggles, you know, and the little modulations are just the statistics of the samples. Okay, so I have a few minutes, and I'll say a little bit about Higgs. This is not something I know very much about, but I'll do my best. So what we have seen so far is that at this energy, it's safe to say that the best sensitivity will be from the Higgs to W plus W minus decay channel. The dominant production is from glu-glu to Higgs. This is the cross-section as a function of M Higgs right here. And then, unfortunately, the whole story about the low-mass Higgs, where you would use this outrageously rare decay of Higgs to gamma-gamma to try to discover the Higgs, we're not going to be able to do this with good sensitivity until we have something like of order 10 inverse femtobarn at 14 TeV. So that's basically the short answer to this question. This plot is one of the standard plots, and it shows you this gamma-gamma branching fraction. You can see that all these Higgs modes, you're decaying into di-object final states. The WW is up here, okay, and of course you have to be at a reasonably high mass to even produce this WW. The gamma-gamma would be the way to access the low Higgs mass because the BB bar, which has a large branching fraction, cannot be extracted from the background. So this this is an estimate of the sensitivity for the Higgs to WW, and it's made in this way that people have started doing, where you look at the ratio of the cross-section relative to the standard model cross-section on this axis as a function of Higgs mass, and you look and see where does your sensitivity fall, so that you could see something at least as low as the standard model would predict. So the standard model is this, and if your sensitivity is better than that, that means that you have sensitivity at the standard model level. And so what this is showing is that at 7 TeV and 1 inverse femtobarn, in other words, this run, we will be able to have sensitivity over this range right here, something like 150 to 185 GeV. Now, so this is an exclusion plot. There's a discovery level sensitivity where you're asking, can you actually discover this at 5 sigma or some number of sigma of significance? And this is this plot as a function of Higgs mass. So there's a narrow region here in Higgs mass where you have something like 5-ish sigma significance.
Has Fermilab already excluded that range?
I have a plot. They've not excluded all of this range. It's a narrower range, and I can probably fish through my backup slides and find whatever the narrow. It's pretty narrow, so the answer is not yet. And I don't think I'm the right person to answer the question of when they add all the rest of their data. Let's say 10 inverse femtobarns. I couldn't predict exactly where they'll get to. So there are. I won't go through much more of these examples. There are a vast number of weird models. This is actually not so weird. The Z prime is predicted in many standard model extensions. And what this plot shows you is for various, 1.5 TeV and 1 TeV Z prime masses, what luminosity would you need to get to for these 95% confidence level or for 10 events? We're sitting here at 7 TeV. So if we wanted to do a 95% confidence level at 7 TeV, we need of order 100 inverse picobarns. Whoops. So the conclusion is that we will have sensitivity beyond the Tevatron at 100 inverse picobarns. And we've learned that this is almost a generic statement about almost all the new physics that we do. There's some things that we could actually do with 5 inverse picobarns that are a little bit weird and kooky. The Higgs is a story that you need an inverse femtobarn, but a lot of the stuff that has cross sections of the picobarn scale.
You've got a timer on that one slide.
Oh, okay.
Whether you know it or not.
Yes, right. So that's the statement, is that 100 inverse picobarns of understood data, then we will be crossing the Tevatron. Okay, so the last thing I know people ask about the accelerator and so forth. This is a slide that was just shown by Steve Myers in LHC status report. And you can click on this link and you can find out about the strategy for the beam intensity. He says the magic number for 2010-11 is 1 inverse femtobarn. To achieve this, the LHC must run flat out at 210 to the 32. So to remind you, right now we're about 110 to the 28. This is what they're going to do. The energy is 35 megajoules of stored energy. So that's impressive. They will have 700 bunches. So that's what we're in for this year. Okay, so my conclusions. The LHC physics program has finally begun. The run at 7 TeV will provide sensitivity to new physics beyond the Tevatron limits. Both of the detectors are working extremely well. We had a whole extra year in which to commission them. One thing that I didn't particularly emphasize in the talk, but the physics program will advance through many different eras where we're able to access different levels of cross sections, because this machine will go through stages of luminosities that change by orders of magnitude. It won't just be factors of two increase and then another factor of two increase. There will be orders of magnitude as time goes by. And then it will almost be like starting a whole new physics program and a whole new machine and a whole...
Well, instead of talking about the time to double the data set, it's time to, it's, to increase it by right. factor of 10 will be...
That's normally not the way we talk about accelerator physics programs. We talk about normally the time to double. Okay. So, I mean, it could be that we discover SUSY immediately. Well, probably not, but you could discover it in principle with 100 inverse picobarns, but it might not be there, and you might not see anything whatsoever until you're at 10 inverse femtobarns, or 100 inverse femtobarns. It's and you might not have any clue of this until you're getting there. So I think that for the next 20 years or so, this will keep us very busy, and I hope keep us with a lot of exciting results to share with you guys. Thank you.
You didn't really describe these data-driven background analyses, but one thing I've always worried about is the possibility of new physics, such as supersymmetry, contaminating what you thought was the background.
It does do that. It will definitely do that. Yes, so that's one of the big challenges, and in particular, the LM0 cross-section of 40 picobarns is so high that it will contaminate the top control samples. So we do have a method, though, I'm pretty sure, we have a method that will be able to handle that particular problem. Not all the methods deal with that very gracefully. So when I said that we had seven methods for doing the single lepton SUSY analysis, some of them get into trouble with exactly that problem. Others of them are much more robust. So nevertheless, you want to do all the methods you can and see if they agree, but that's absolutely right.
If you had these events with Luino stop in the calorimeter, would you be able to distinguish between Luino decaying into a single gluon versus Luino decaying into jets? Or no?
I don't think so. I don't. I'm not an expert on the analysis.
There's no tracks.
There's no tracks. No.
Yeah, it's just an energy deposit in a. Yeah, you don't have tracking there. You have scintillator. It's not a segmented system in terms of being able to. You have layers of scintillator alternating with layers of brass. Gary?
So the four orders of magnitude increase in luminosity that you have to get this year.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a lot to somebody. I mean, is part of that sort of easy? You just add more bunches, crank up some knobs,
yes.
or something.
Yes.
Like that.
But that's not easy. It's straightforward conceptually. But they want to be very, very confident that they can handle the stored energy associated with that safely, because you have to be able to dump that energy of that entire bunch train on the time scale of a turn. Because if you lose control over the bunch train and it hits the accelerator, well, it's, you know, when, at full luminosity, it's like the energy, kinetic energy of a 747 taking off is being stored inside your accelerator. So you absolutely have to be able to abort the beam and get it off to a beam dump. Very carefully.
In these tiny, wimpy little Fermi lab, Tevatron beams cause an awful lot of damage when they're lost. And that lesson's been learned. So they're going to be easing up the number of bunches very, very carefully. So you say, including if lightning strikes in Geneva, these things have to fail in a way that it kicks the beam out at the right point.
Or if a bird drops a baguette on the...
Yeah. I've been told that they have thunderstorms in Geneva, Switzerland, as well as in Geneva, Illinois. I don't know what it was there.
So for your specific SUSY analysis, for some of your benchmarks, and is B-tagging involved in those signals?
Is B-tagging what?
Involved in those signals.
So, okay.
It's a B-rich
sample. Okay. SUSY loves Bs. Okay. And vast numbers of SUSY models produced many, many B quarks. So it's really very, very clear that B tagging will be of great value in many of these things. It has not been used in any study that I showed you. Okay. So we are fairly optimistic that B tagging will be employed early on. And there doesn't seem to be anything major standing in the way of that. So, you know, things will, some of the analyses could, well, what will happen most likely is that the analyses will develop a branch where you add B-tagging and one where you won't use B-tagging because nobody knows a priori what model nature has implemented, if any. So we will have a version with, a version without.
How do they calibrate B-tagging for false positive sufficiency?
Well, there are a lot of ways to do that. I mean, you have tagging with leptons, you have tagging with the vertex, and you can play these off against each other and things like that. So if you want a B-tagging efficiency, let's say 50% is not a crazy kind of number to talk about, then you could, you know, you're contending with some amount of fake rate of 10 to the minus 3 or something. And you have to decide in the case of that particular analysis whether that fake rate is acceptable, depending on what particular backgrounds come in. Some backgrounds, such as TT bar, produce an awful lot of Bs. And so the B tagging won't suppress that background. It would suppress a background like W plus Jets. Or Z, another example is Z plus Jets, where Z goes to nu nu bar.
It could be, you can easily give you four Bs.
Yeah.
So you will see more Bs than TT bar.
Yeah. No, right. Everyone is definitely aware of that, and that's being pushed.
Another question. There are certain supersymmetric models that predict that Higgs is lighter than 114 GeV and avoid at the same time the left bound. So is the LHC prepared to observe something like that?
What's the signature? Is this a Susie Higgs?
Light jets, yeah.
Well, just generic
some
Higgs.
Guy,
for example, Higgs can decay to
Higgs
can
or top down.
Four Bs.
Oh yeah, there. I think I have to confess, I really don't know about this stuff, but there is a. Okay, my answer would be maybe, because I don't really know, but I know that there are searches that remind me of that, and whether it's exactly what you're asking, I'm not sure.
It's going to be harder.
There are searches for Susi signatures involving taus with the Higgs. Does that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's really about all I know.
He's talking about this Gaudin variety Higgs search, but just Higgs as a final state, different final state.
Okay, so this is a slide which may or may not answer your question, but there's a mechanism where you get this phi is meant to stand for various.
That's the pseudo scalar usually.
This is meant to be any of the neutral Higgses, and then this decays into tau tau. And this plot is meant to show this is some Tevatron exclusion region. And then this curve is a 95% exclusion in CMS with one inverse femtobond. So, but I guess, you know, this is not really answering your question because you're trying to go below 100, aren't you? Yeah, so I'm sorry, it doesn't. If you could tell me that signature.
Well, people at least used to say that if you're modestly optimistic and you have the full 14 TeV, et cetera, then for the MSSM, you could cover the whole parameter space, but I don't know how absolute
measure is. Yeah, so this one is still the MSSM search, right?
Yeah.
Usually that phi stands for pseudo-scalar because that coupling is 10.
Well, but it doesn't stand for that here.
But this one is MSSM because the signature he's talking about is at least an MSSM.
Is it at least an
It's an H decays to two light scalars, and two light scalars each do whatever they want to decay to. Usually they want to decay to BB bar or tau tau. Mm-hmm. So you'll have a Higgs production. The decay product is 4B, 2B, 2 tau, or 4 tau. That's the.
Well, it if, it's just, if all it is multiple jets, that's not. Going to be
you
good.
You will have tops.
Yeah. That could be very, very hard because if you just have multiple jets and you don't really, and it's not a very heavy thing, it's just going to be totally swamped by QCD background.
And in this scenario, you usually lose gamma gamma completely because the width to this is pretty wide. So I think this is a very hard scenario for LHC. Definitely not very discovery. It's much bigger.
The indication that existing Monte Carlo is not working well for certain time scope servables at this moment?
Is there any indication that the existing Monte Carlo is not working well?
For certain time scope servables,
yeah,
against data.
Yeah, there are.
Soft tracks.
Soft tracks. The number, the multiplicity of soft tracks is underestimated by the PIPIA. So there's some Monte Carlo workshop thing going on where people are trying to tune that.
Which is not that reasonable because at this energy.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a big surprise, but it's definitely.
I think even in some, there's been some history of every new energy that's been discovered.
It's probably sensitive to hydrolyzation, which hasn't been killed, really, I guess.
It probably doesn't matter much.
Well, it depends, but you know, you'd like to get it, you'd like to fix it for sure. I mean,
it's not going to hurt your savings.
Yes, that's the main thing that has turned up.
But overall, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions? Well, I want to remind everybody we have another seminar by Jonathan at 1:30, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.